This is the Living Clean Podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. All right, welcome back to the Living Clean Podcast. I'm Mason S. I'm an addict. We're back for another episode. This week we're going to feature a personal story, but before we get into that, we're going to do some introductions. I'm going to start with the co-host, Francis.
Francis Addict, December 22nd, 1992. I have a home group called Spiritual Reality. But also I'm involved with just starting up a new group that's a book study that meets at 6:30 in the morning twice a week. We haven't named it yet. So maybe like by the next recording, we'll have a name for our early morning book study. But it's been super sweet starting a new adventure with a group. So, yeah, that's me.
Okay, Francis. And our very special guest tonight, Pete.
Hi, I'm Pete, and I'm an addict. Clean dates 1/5/86 in San Diego, California. And my home group for the last 2 years is the Tuesday Manzanan meeting in Iran that I attend every Tuesday and am involved with.
I missed that. Did you say 86?
Yeah. So 86. I just celebrated 39 years a few days ago, as a matter of fact.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Everybody listening, make sure to give Pete a shout out for 39 years when this episode released on the Facebook page.
So you do a Zoom meeting in Iran?
I do. This strikes me a little weird, but they want me to share every week, and part of the meeting with through an interpreter is a guided meditation. And for the last year we've been using the Spiritual Principle a Day book, and I share on that through an interpreter for a total of about 40 minutes, and then it's Q&A for an hour or two or three or more. And it's very rewarding, and they're really thirsty for knowledge and direction on spiritual living and how to grow their recovery.
Well, that is fascinating.
There's a lot of long-term recovery there, but it's been kind of, since they had before COVID, they were really an isolated society and culture of NA, totally reliant on our literature for guidance, where those of us in the United States have had the benefit of a lot of lived recovery and a different kind of developing recovery as we live the program over the years, and that changes.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think COVID, if there's been a benefit of that, I mean, it's really benefited the fellowship in that way, is, you know, we found a way to connect worldwide. And I bet they really feel like they're a part of something bigger. You know,
as a matter of fact, this podcast, you know, like recording over Zoom is, you know, like a direct result of probably the pandemic making Zoom so available to everybody.
Oh, no doubt.
It's another example of shit turning into roses.
No doubt. That, I mean, figuratively and literally with this podcast, because when it first started, that's what it was shit. Oh, I can say that because I was there in the beginning. I know.
Definitely it's about progress, not perfection.
It has been. And I can admit when it was bad, and now that it's progressing and getting better, I can admit that too. So
San Diego 1986, what was that like?
Well, I got clean in Redondo Beach area that was called Bay Area back then. And it was a pretty rich bed of recovery with a fair amount of good long-term recovery. By long-term, that meant like 5 or 10 or 15 years at the time. And I'm really grateful that I got the program the way I did. I'm happy that we have literature in Iran. I don't know that they would have had the fellowship they have without the step working guide.
Yeah.
But I'm really grateful that we didn't have that when I got clean, and that I got the advantage of what I call kitchen table recovery.
Mm.
We sat down and talked about what's going on in life and how to work the steps on that, rather than using something predetermined or a format.
Yeah, wouldn't it be interesting to get back to something that kind of integrates both of those philosophies? Because I think one way or the other, we really miss out on something, you know, like to actually sit down and have those discussions. And something my sponsees and I have been working on, I've actually used AI to come up with step questions that lead to deep discussions. I mean, that's literally the way I put it into the algorithm and ask it to build that for me. And it's been great, you know, just because you feel like you miss out on that.
I think that's brilliant, Mason. And, you know, we get reliant on things that are safe and easy to use. So there was a period of years where I was chairing the regional Behind the Walls committee and built that up from two members to a really large functioning committee. And for working with inmates, that's the step working guide is invaluable. And it's a comfortable way. Look, when we start sponsoring people, we're all a little fearful. We don't know if we can do it or do it right, and are we up to it? So step working guide is a very valuable tool and something to rely on that's fellowship approved, and it will work. But ideally, it's not a substitute for conversations. And having this kind of, you know, look, when I got clean in 86, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have internet. And we drove to each other's house and we hung out. And I would go run errands with my sponsor and just hang out as he went to the bank or paid a bill. And it was a time to really get to know each other and see how we lived.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the way the world was in 86 to now. We have people that literally this year will be 5 years clean and maybe have never been to an in-person meeting.
Right.
Or maybe they've never met their sponsor in person.
Yeah.
That's a crazy idea to think about.
Or being sponsored from the other side of the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Or leading meditations in around
through a translator.
Yeah. And during the pandemic, I was doing some meetings where we'd feature the different authors in the basic text, and we had translators translating, like the Russian author, the Japanese author. Like we would get a hold of the author, and then everything's translated through WhatsApp and you know, like in Facebook, you know, like we had the technology back then, but we had to find the people to do it too. So it created a lot of logistical issues for us, but yeah, what a miracle.
It is a miracle. And you can't get all the answers out of a book. It takes human interaction. And Iran, the fellowship grew so quickly for a number of reasons that, as you may probably know, step workshops were done with 30, 50, 100, or 200 people all going through the book at the same time. So one-on-one sponsorship was absolutely unavailable for the first 10, 15, 20 years of the Iranian fellowship.
Wow.
And people still got clean and stayed clean, but they want to know how to nuance their recovery.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating questions that came up repeatedly in a period was, how do I make amends to people I have molested or assaulted? And yeah, you can't get that kind of information out of a book.
Well, let's go back to 1986 for a minute. I just want to kind of get your first interaction, how you found Narcotics Anonymous. Like what was your first meeting like? What was your first thoughts about the fellowship?
Well, I hit my first rehab in 1968. I was 14 years old. and it was a place that was not affiliated with Narcotics Anonymous, called Synanon, one of the early long-term rehabilitation centers. And at that point, I was a kid who felt like I was in junkie graduate school. You know, by the time I got to NA, which was 1984, I started knocking on the doors here, my life was in a much different place, and I was obviously having undeniable consequences of active addiction and knew I needed to stop, but just didn't know how to. And you guys, the fellowship, was able to tell me about the gifts of recovery. They were able to tell me what to do, exactly how to stay clean, which hasn't changed. Go to meetings, read the literature, get a sponsor, set up the meetings, be of service, call somebody every day, get your phone numbers. But nobody could tell me how to surrender. So I had a problem feeling like I fit in, and I had a problem with the God language of our steps and literature. And to be honest, getting loaded still looked good to me. You know, long after I knew I needed to clean up and didn't know how to go on, the idea of my chin on my chest was attractive to me. The idea of my fixation on what I thought was happiness, even though it was causing suffering and problems, it took the fellowship couldn't teach me that my idea of happiness was the suffering. It took a lot of pain for me to get rendered teachable and to come in and let go of all of my thoughts and objections and doubts and not stop wondering if I could stay clean or if you were for real, but to let pain be my guide. And that's kind of been a recurring theme in my life.
I guess this is as good a time as any to bring this up. You know, recently, just a week ago, actually 9 days ago, I lost my mom. You know, Peter, you were one of the ones that reached out to me, and I just met you, I think, a week or so before that on doing a podcast that will be last week's episode. So if you're listening to this, it'll be last week's episode. That's when I met Peter, and you reached out after you heard the news about my mom, and you said something that I haven't been able to get out of my head, talking about, and I don't have the message with me, but you were talking about how sometimes this, our heart goes through like this tenderizing process through this pain. And something about what you were just saying kind of made me think about that again. And it's so true, man. Like that's, I can feel that. Like I feel softer and gentler, and, yeah, I just do, you know, and I've been through a lot of that since I've been clean, and I know I've not been clean as long as you guys have, nowhere near, but unfortunately, death has been a reoccurring theme of people that I really care about since I've gotten clean, and I love the way that you described that, the tenderizing process, because that's exactly how I feel, you know, and as bad as those things are, I always seem to find myself in a better place after each one of them for some reason. And yeah, but I think I just bring that up to say, first of all, thank you for reaching out. It meant a lot. Francis as well. Francis has been, he's checked on me every day. And yeah, I'm grateful for y'all. And, you know, so I guess that leads to my question for you is, you know, where did this insight come from about this tenderizing of the heart?
I'll answer your question indirectly in a way and directly in a minute. What are the key turning points in our lives? Okay. I remember the first time I took opiates, my older brother, Richard, gave me some pills I won't mention because we typically don't name drugs here. And he said, Pete, you're going to probably get sick to your stomach and vomit, but that don't worry about it. That's just part of the high. And these days are usually, if you're throwing up, you're sick and it's a big deal, but because it was framed around pleasure or something useful or I thought I wanted, vomiting was no big deal, right? That was like an important life lesson, even though I had it upside down for 20 years, you know? So when we think of our life in recovery and the unparalleled freedom and joy and meaning that we have via the program, I look back on it and see that what I thought was the suffering of my bottom was actually the doorway to this incredible freedom that was beyond my dreams. And that's what we have in common. You know, were you going to say something or should I continue? So what happened when we hit bottom? Our literature, it works how and why in the beginning of the first step says, as addicts, we know the fear, loneliness, and despair of active addiction. And all of a sudden, these things I dreaded and ran from my whole life, fear, loneliness, despair, actually were the best thing that ever happened to me because it rendered me teachable and it clarified that getting high was the problem. And if I didn't get high again, I'd never have to feel this way again. I might still have some fear and loneliness, but I wouldn't feel this way again. And I'm really grateful for that. And what's kept me clean 39 years is I've never forgotten and don't want to forget what it felt like in my gut, in my chest, the taste in my mouth, and that moment when I hit a bottom. Living in my pinno, court cases, and my world absolutely falling apart. So to me, it sounds weird, but my idea of happiness is what got me to the program. You know, and we are, and I'm an addict, I want to feel good and I chase happiness, but it's the suffering, it's the pain that had the most profound impact on my life long term and has led to the greatest reward. So in 2002, I'd been married. I was 16 years clean. And I think it was 16. Yeah, 16 years clean. I'd been married for some years, for 10 years, 11 years. And my stepson suddenly dropped dead. Undiagnosed heart condition. And I call him, I often call him my son because I don't have a biological son and I raised him as a son and he saw me as his father. And it was one of those key events that propelled my life in a direction and into an area of freedom and spiritual growth and meaning that I couldn't have dreamed of the week before. So when you get clean, that first year was the most dramatic and incredible year of change. Man, I went from living in a car to sleeping on a couch to getting a job and eventually having my own place and feeling like I fit in and having some confidence in my ability to stay clean. And life was like meaningful and great and I was socially accepted and of service. But at 16 years, when David died, everything I thought was important, the whole construction of my life fell down briefly. And I recognized that what was really important was how well I loved and how open and receptive I was to his love. You know, in that moment of death, everything that's important the day before or the hour before, the bills don't matter, you know? And my first response, quite naturally, was, why is this happening to me? How can this happen to me? I've got a sponsor. I go to meetings. I sponsor other people of him service. I've raised him really wonderfully. He's never seen me loaded. I've done everything I can. I'm a good member. Why is this happening to me? Why, you know? And then I recognize that this didn't happen at me or to me. It was a gift that I was able to bear witness and be here for that. You know, we all have our own higher power. We're all on our own sacred journey. And out of David's death, the results over a period of some years were learning and doing investigation of grief and coming up with the conviction that my deepest regret wasn't for anything I failed to do. And I was honest and he knew I loved him and we were current. My greatest regret was that I missed opportunities just to be fully present. That this amazing being was in my life and I took it for granted. And I was stuck in the role of being a father. So that I went head to head with him, brush your teeth, make your bed, do your homework, blah, blah, blah. And when he dies, how important is any of that stuff? You know, it was the right thing to do, I thought, but I just wished I had shown up more fully, more with more presence. And that kind of became a vow I made to try and learn how to show up with complete presence more actively in the moments of life, including now with each of you.
Francis and I were talking before you got on, Pete, and he was asking me about where I was at. And, you know, I felt bad because right after that happened, I was right in the middle of a 90 and 90. I had made about 35 consecutive meetings. And this time I wanted to do something different, not only commit to doing, I like to do that when it starts getting dark really early here in Tennessee. And I committed to that and, you know, calling my sponsor every day, praying and meditating and either journaling or writing on step work. One or two questions are journaling. And I had done that 35 consecutive days and I felt terrible because after, you know, my mom passed, I didn't make a meeting that day. And Francis made this point. He said, see, God had a way of preparing you for what was coming. And I got to say that the day that I got the news, which was on New Year's Day, spiritually, I was in as good a place as I've ever been. You know, like I was prepared. I wasn't prepared for the news, but it was something that I could not only, you know, deal with my own stuff, but also be there for my family too. 'Cause this didn't just affect me. You know, I've got a sister, I've got, you know, all my sister's kids, my mom's grandkids, super close with my mom, you know, and unfortunately it was my 21-year-old niece is the one that found her, you know, and so she's been going through it. And, you know, being able to not be selfish and think about how bad I'm hurting, but also take the time to give her comfort and peace and be there for her too, you know. So I didn't have those skills or ability to do those sort of things before I got involved in NA. I've learned that through y'all's experience. You know, because I would come, you know, I go into meetings all the time. You hear people go through something similar and I get to learn and, you know, it's almost like, I've got a playbook when these things happen sometimes, you know, and I'm grateful for that. But yeah, I thought that was a great point that Francis has made, you know, and I feel a little bit better now about breaking my commitment of my 90 and 90. But yeah, that makes sense. You know, I was being prepared for what was to come. And, yeah, you know, today, roughly 9 days later, I'm in a good spot again. You know, like I miss my mom tremendously. Like I miss her. I mean, I do. Life was somewhat normal today, you know, went to work, got off of work, came here, did the podcast. You know, things are getting back to normal. And that's a gift that y'all gave me. Because two things happened. First, I lost my mom, and then I got like flu-like symptoms right after that happened. So I just think about my ability to get through either one of those things 10 years ago wasn't possible. Wasn't possible.
Well, death is like withdrawals too, you know?
Yeah.
Breakups can be like going through withdrawals.
Yeah, it's a good point. Never thought about that.
Oh, I was going to say that not only what that 90-90 put him in play, but you know, like we were pushing to get a couple of episodes ahead with the podcast, and I'm like, man, it's a good thing we put some in the bank, because like we spent them while we took some time off, you know, like when we needed it, and like God not only was taking care of Mason, but he was taking care of some of Mason's projects, and like it was all pretty divinely inspired. I was thinking about something Rumi said. He said the wound is the place where the light comes in, and like so we were talking about, you know, like the gift of desperation that gets us here, but I think it also some, you know, like crisis happens, you know, like life on life's terms isn't, you know, like just because you're clean doesn't mean everything is going to go great. We still have to live life on life's terms. And the part of life is death, you know, like, and like we, it prepares us, you know, like we learn how to manage our lives better now that we are clean and we have support. And I was thinking about the campfire, right? Like the fires down in Southern California, we had a real devastating one up here, and everybody in the fellowship was taken care of. You know, like none of them landed in the homeless, like in the shelters that were set up at the fairgrounds. I was like working those shelters, and I didn't see any active members like in the shelter. And what that looked like was everybody was either had intact families or they had couches, you know, like to land on in the fellowship. And like, so that's, there's a piece, you know, like where we have tools and people in our lives. Our lives are rich with people when these kind of things happen, that we're able to connect with them. You know, like not like we're like me and Mason, we cut it up, and you know, like we're a little bit opposite politically, and you know, like, but you know, like we love each other, and we, you know, like I got you.
Yeah.
He called me the day after the election to see if I was okay. You know, like that. That's the important stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of that is remembering what we really most deeply want to be about. And in the beginning, something like the third step means, okay, I want to stay clean and I'm not going to use no matter what. And if I'm really going to do a third step, okay, I'll do the inventory, you know. But as we live in the program for long-term recovery and make repeated investigations through the 12 steps, I'm hoping that our understanding is deepening, and what we're getting, what we're extracting is allowed to come and be fresh, you know, to where, okay, yeah, okay, and most deeply God's will for me is to love and be loved. Well, what the hell does that mean? What does it mean when my nervous system is reacting due to politics, war, whatever? What does love really look like here? After David's death, we wound up going to a Buddhist monastery. My wife was really trying to make some sense out of this, and I kind of got involved in a committed practice of mindfulness and meditation. It was out of his death that I really developed for the first time, 16 years clean, a committed daily practice of meditation. And it helped me renew and refresh my commitment to be fully present in life, okay? It wasn't to get through grief or to bypass anything or to achieve a state of bliss. It was practicing presence. But how do we remember to do that? Okay, so I started doing end of life work because I wanted to keep that intimacy with of death. I wanted to keep intimate with remembering how fragile my life is and our lives are, to refresh what's important is the way we're showing up for each other. Yeah. And I had a sponsee whose wife got ALS, and it's a horrible degenerative illness where you gradually lose control of your muscles. And as she was losing functionality, they were both wanting a meditation practice. And this amazing woman, Carrie, reached a point where she couldn't move. And if a fly landed on her when she was meditating, that became the object of her meditation, rather than something to push away or swat away like we would. She harmonized with it. And what I saw from what you were talking about, Francis, like in Paradise, California, as her need for help and her mother's need for help and her husband's need for help outgrew their capacity to do it alone, they had to ask for help, which is so hard for us. And it gave the community a chance to step forward and contribute and show up. So that by the time Carrie was intubated and she had already made it clear she didn't want to live on a machine, and asked a few of us to be in the room with her when they unplugged the machine, when they took the tube out. The waiting room had 75 people in it, like 50 or 75 people. So the spiritual value of this is the call for the rest of us to step up one more time. Out of tragedy, we can grow love. Out of the cracks in our heart, we're letting light in, if we're spiritually awake, which I hope we are, thanks to the program. And it was like, I remember being invited into the waiting room, into her room. The family wanted me there to do a meditation and say a prayer or something. And they talked about how peaceful I was. And I remember thinking, who, me? You got the wrong person here. But they knew me as somebody who had been doing end of life and was motivated by love and care and kindness. And it's taken me years, and I'm still working on getting rid of my old ideas about myself. I mean, there's always more work to do, right? And this idea, what's really alive for me these days, and I hope I'm not going on too long, is the call to live in aspiration, not results. So when I learned the third step, they said, you know what, Pete, that means you're responsible for the footwork, but we leave the results up to God. You're not responsible for the results. Well, as I learned to look deeply at what we're doing in recovery, like stay 6 and 7, right? We've all done step 6 and 7. We have investigated our defects and how they're blocking us. We've nourished this desire to be free of them and to learn what assets are important to us. We have come up with absolute, complete, wholehearted willingness to ask our higher power to free us, to remove all of these character defects, right? Are they gone? And then being someone who's programmed to negativity with shame and inadequacy and unworthiness, I became convinced that what's the point? I really gave it my best and I really did everything you told me to do to be free of my defects. I asked God to remove them and I've still got them. What the fuck? You dig? And the point was, it's the aspiration that's the perfection, not the practice, because life is both a point and a wave. We have these moments in time where we're absolutely free of character defects, like the moment where we wholeheartedly asked for them to be removed. At that moment, we are totally free of character defects. Just because I get in the car and flip somebody off driving to work 10 minutes later doesn't mean that that's failed at all. Okay? It means that I know who and what I want to be about, and that's where I'm setting a spiritual, my GPS. Or like this idea of the 12th step of, you know, we practice these principles in all of our affairs. Well, thank God that's not predicated on perfection. It's the aspiration to live spiritually. It's the aspiration to love and be loved. It's the aspiration to be of service and to help another. It's this aspiration to, when we talk about helping an addict be free of addiction or to help those who are suffering, to me, that's called compassion. When I recognize someone's suffering and have a desire to help reduce that or help them be free of that, which is another word for love, right? So the idea of deconstructing my narratives that tell me I'm a failure or it's hopeless or I'll never be able to practice unconditional love, that narrative is a lie. It's a fabrication. It's a lie because I make these snapshots of unskillfulness into the whole movie of a failure, which defies the moments where we're sharing from the heart and we're listening from the heart, where we're caring for each other and we're lifting each other up. So when it comes to grief, I've lost two long-term sponsors. I've lost both my parents. I've lost so many dear friends. And I sit and meditate on grief as because when I'm grieving, I still have a daily practice. And this grief that feels so devastating, like unrequited love. I love them so much and they're gone. That's unrequited love. But when I get past my narrative about it being unrequited love, I can touch the love in the grief. You dig? All of a sudden, I've come to realize that grief, the depth of this dark, bottomless hole of grief is a reflection of the height of my love and my care that I had for this person. So when I look into the grief, it's a reflection of love and I can discover the love at the base. And then it's about how do I use this to soften my heart and grow my capacity for love. And I think that's our work here.
Yeah.
Isn't just to love, it's to learn how to refine and nuance our idea of what love looks like in any situation, and to learn how to grow our capacity for love, which for me, just like hitting bottom in a way, I learn to grow my ability, my capacity for love when I can touch the unlovable with love. Hmm. When I can be lovingly present for grief or fear or loneliness or sadness or shame. Ooh, that's a tough one. When we learn how to touch it with the hand, be the hand of NA, the loving, caring hand of the fellowship that can just touch and hold our hurts. Because I don't think there's any part of us that is more needing and deserving love than the parts of us that hurt. But I can't think my way there. It means I have to bring it to the heart. And find a way to let go of my thoughts and judgments and differences and likes and dislikes. So that's kind of how my life is unfolding. It's where unconditional love meets the conditioning that I have the opportunity to become more loving. It's when my defects of character are no longer the walls that limit me, but their friends saying, hey, Pete, this is how you really want to be. Because the point of 6 and 7 isn't so much eradicating or putting my defects in solitary confinement. It's befriending them and letting them remind me that, wait a minute, I want to practice generosity, not greed. I want to practice kindness rather than intolerance. Let me practice understanding for a minute. So when defects become friends that are pointing us to what we most want to grow, and not in my head, in my heart, then all of a sudden they're assets too. All of a sudden fear, this horrible feeling of fear that I deny, that is the root of all of my resentments and character defects, I can recognize that fear thinks it's love. Because fear just wants to protect us, but it's a kind of ignorant love that freezes me and locks me up. Okay? It hardens my heart and shuts me down, freezes me. So I can care for fear and learn to even be a friend of fear by touching the love in fear. It's not the enemy anymore. Maybe it has good intention, but it doesn't know how to really help.
I was, boy, that was so cool. I was like following along, and I was taking notes, not because I had questions, but because I was trying to get some of this down on paper. But I was thinking about anonymity, and like, I will like hammer away at like, we're supposed to be treating everybody the same way. You know, like, we're supposed to be hugging the homeless guy that comes in that we don't think has a desire to stop using. He just wants to drink our coffee and shoot up in our bathroom. Like we don't want to hug him, but we want to hug the pretty newcomer girl with the nice hair, you know, like that smells good. You know, like, so like I have a tendency to hammer away at like our groups. Like we gotta love everybody. We gotta love everybody. But when I was listening to you talk about our character defects and treating our character defects with unconditional love and anonymity, I'm like, and they could be our friends that point us to the direction where we want to be. That was so cool. Like, man, I could practice anonymity with myself and my character defects, at, you know, like, and love them into compliance. You know, like, hug my shame, you know, like, or my anger, or you know, like, I'm like, I love you, and my anger's like, fuck you, you know, like, but yeah, wow, thank you.
Yeah, one thing that I was thinking about while you were sharing that is when I first got clean. I got clean 9 months after my father passed away. I was in the room with my dad, and I've told this story on here a bunch of times, but I was unaware. I knew that he went to these things called meetings. I didn't know what they were. Didn't know much about them. He told me he was the chairperson one night. He said, I have to go because I have to chair the meeting. So to me, he was the president of NA. So that's what I used to tell all my friends. My dad's the president of that. 9 months or 9 months before I got clean, yeah, we were in the hospital at the end of his life, and I watched the number of people come in and show their love and support and gratitude and share that with them. And you know, I didn't know what that was, but I knew that I wanted it. And that love is what got me interested in what NA was. And long story short, I get clean. I get a sponsor and I start working steps, and I worked the steps the first time out of the step working guide. And when I can remember getting to the reservation section, I was just looking at this the other day. I still got my first step work. I was looking at the reservations and I mentioned something that I thought would be too painful to get to 9 months after losing my dad would be losing my mom. Or losing one of my brothers or sisters. But in the past year, I've lost two sisters and my mom. Probably 6 months before that, my brother calls me one night in the middle of the night freaking out. He found his 20-year-old son overdosed and he passed away. I say all that to say this, is that those were my biggest fears. Those were my biggest concerns about. I did not see a way in the beginning of how I could get through that and get through it clean. But that's the gift that y'all have given me, is not only did, I mean, I exceeded my expectations as far as what I could get through on my, what I listed as my reservations. Like, I went far above and beyond that, and still, you know, and all those times, I never once considered the idea of getting loaded. And that's a gift y'all give me, you know, and I'm so grateful. And I can't even fathom, like, what is it today that fear or anger or resentment has got me, you know, held back from that I'm going to let go of, and somewhere in the future, I'm going to find a new freedom or a new thing that I didn't think I could get through. are, you know, maybe this time it'll be something very positive, instead of tragic. But even if it is tragic, there's not a doubt in my mind that no matter what happens today, I can get through it and get through it clean. And that's a gift. And I owe that to y'all, you know, all of you. You guys on here, the ones out there listening, grateful for that.
Not only that, you use their lives and their deaths, or I do, I think you do, to deepen our recovery, to renew and deepen our commitment to living this life, to honor them. And that's where, out of the loss, we are growing the connection by honoring them and keeping them alive for me. I keep David, I keep my mom, I keep Ham and Hank alive in my heart. I want to keep them with me and a part of my life. But there's something I wanted to touch on, if time allows,
No, go
which
for
is
it.
we have these moments of realization, we have these moments of awakening, and then, I'd go on a meditation retreat and I'd have 5 days of harmony and love. And even though meditation can really be hell too, it can bring up a lot of suffering, and I'd be feeling very spiritually fit, and then get in the car and somebody cuts me off. And I'm calling them names without a second thought. So as I investigate how I tick, which is what the steps are teaching me, take time to stop and to look deeply. What are my stories? What are my narratives? What's really going on inside? I recognize that I have a head, I have thoughts, I have a desire for this. But I'm also, my mind is always cutting things into pieces. So they talk about bringing the head to the heart. They used to say the longest journey is the head to the heart. Because in the heart, we love unconditionally. The heart is inclusive. The heart is where our traditions are unity and acceptance and inclusiveness. Well, when we bring the head to when we go from the head to the heart, we got to bring the head with us to the heart. Instead of trying to just leave the head behind. Because when head and heart are together, then we're more whole. And if I want to be whole, I need the fear, I need the shame, I need all the parts of myself. I can't be, I need anonymity over all the parts. I can't be selective about which parts I want to include and which ones I want to exclude. So I check out this stuff about why do I get fearful, intolerant, angry, upset? And I recognize that we have a head and a heart, but we also have a gut. We have a nervous system. And I've really, the last few years since COVID, we practice learning to love in the rooms. And then when COVID hit, it was all about social distancing. And if somebody got too close, there was fear and I'd pull away, right? This is nervous system, okay? So recognizing that nervous system does not negate love, it functions independently of the heart. So just because I get fearful and angry and intolerant, the nervous system is constantly scanning for threat. We're programmed to notice what's wrong at a 7 or 9 to 1 ratio over what's right. It's an old survival mechanism. It's called a negativity bias, okay? We can practice and train ourselves to see what's right, but that doesn't mean bypassing or ignoring the parts of me that are pulling away. You dig? So I love recovery, man. I love this program. I love the steps. I love our path. So the end result is a spiritual awakening. The end result of 1 through 11 is a spiritual awakening. How do I know what that is? And we don't talk about it because we all know we're imperfect. We all know our flaws and fallibility. So how can I talk about a spiritual awakening when I'm so imperfect and can be mean to somebody or short with them, impatient? And for me, I needed to get the smell and feel of spiritual awakening. And for me, that's what we've been talking about, this feeling of connectedness. When I'm feeling connected and my heart's soft, I think I'm spiritually awake. And I notice when I'm pushing away and where my heart is walling up, when I'm closing down, is when I'm falling back to the spiritual sleep. And it kind of needs both of those too. But this deal with the nervous system and becoming more aware of what's going on in my body is the fruit of 11 step. Because I have had body image problems, and I was the youngest of three brothers, and I suffered a lot of abuse, of a variety of abuse growing up. And I learned how to dissociate from my body. And I liked drugs because I could check out.
Yeah.
I could check out in my body. And my body is where fear and shame and all this stuff is. And it's through meditating. The 11th step, what I try and share in Iran and with others as sponsees and friends, is that meditation is not a function of the mind. We don't battle our mind. We can't quiet our mind with our mind. That's doing war with ourselves. For me, with meditation, I'm bringing my awareness to my body. And as I learn to calm my body, drop the shoulders, smile, breathe, and feel the breath and be in my body in a good way, with good intention, right? As my body calms, my mind and feelings naturally calm on their own. And that's, we have the ability to regulate our nervous system with awareness and mindfulness, where the nervous system's not the enemy. The nervous system's doing its job, and it's kept us alive, man. We're all survivors here. And I'll add that for every bit of trauma that every one of us has had, just like grief and love, for all of our traumas and hurts, we have an equal or greater amount of resilience. Because every one of us has survived and bounced back. And our program is really about resilience, and spiritual fitness is about learning how to nourish my resilience. Okay, so that I can be ready for the trials and tribulations of life. When Ham, my dearest sponsor, he was my first sponsor this time back, and then he was dying of this rare illness that was eating the white cells of his brain. And I was bedside with him essentially the last 6-8 weeks of his life in Arizona. And it's like you said, Mason, like you said, Francis, I felt like every moment of my life in recovery had prepared me to be lovingly present for him. And why? Because we learn how to use all of the ingredients in our life. We make use of the resentments. We make use of the defects. We want to recognize the harms we cause, not to feed shame, but to transform and grow freedom and reconciliation. Okay, so we're learning in this spiritual realm how to use all of the parts and turn shit into compost. You dig? If you think about shit, man, my wife's a great cook, and I sit down and she'll make some chili rellenos or a beautiful meal, and I'll eat it and love it. And then I go to the bathroom the next day, and it's like, horrible poop, flush it away, right? Well, that poop isn't just shit. It's made of the wonderful meal. And as cultivators in some kind of spiritual garden, we learn through step work to compost the shit in our life and turn it into fertilizer. And gain the wisdom to know what it is we want to fertilize, what it is we're really wanting to grow and nourish.
Yeah.
So we need it all. There's no waste. And to me, this is like the greatest magic. This is more magic than even being able to take a drug and change my consciousness when I was a teenager or an active, when drugs were really working, I thought.
So you were talking earlier about step three, right? And you were basically talking about getting out of the results committee, right? Like, I do the work, but I'm not in control of the results. That's left to something else. I was listening to this astrophysicist, and one of the questions, he was doing a Q&A, and one of the questions they asked is, if you could change, there's all these laws and rules throughout the universe. If you could change one thing, what would it be? He said, "Well, I want to tell you something before you give me this ability, this theoretical ability." And basically, he broke down E equals MC squared, right? And he says, "What one thing that's there is that there is this constant throughout all these equations that keeps everything together." He says, "If I was to change that by 100, 1 100 billionth of a percent, the consequences would be so drastic." He said, "At first, it would look like something beautiful because the stars in the sky would be brighter, they would be more beautiful, but they would also burn at a rapid pace. And before it was over, everything would be over. And even though it appears on the surface that I did this great thing with this power that you've granted me, the consequences would be severe." You know, so he basically was a fancy way of saying, "I don't want that power." And how many times have I looked back throughout my life and wished that I'd had control, but thank God I didn't. Man, what would I have done? Even though we look at that sometimes, like you were talking about, I didn't know about surrender too. Like surrender was such a negative concept that I grew up as surrender. You don't quit, you don't give up. Like I grew up playing sports and you know, that was like the number one rule, just don't give up no matter what. Who would have ever thought that our surrender is our greatest strength? You know, it's like we have all these vulnerabilities, all these weaknesses, like, but surrender allows us to recognize all these weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And much like the knights back in the day, why were the knights so great? Well, it's because they had sense enough to put metal over their vital organs, you know, so they protected the places that was most vulnerable. They were man enough to say, "Hey, I can't stand a blade to the liver. I'm not going to make it. So let's put a piece of metal over that." And so many times that's how I view surrender in the programs, is saying, "Hey, I do have these problems." But instead of not having the humility to say that I need help or I'm powerless, let's go ahead and admit that and let's begin the process of putting the metal shield over it. And you know, when you were talking about the third step earlier, that's kind of some thoughts that was running through my head.
Yeah, we are taught in the first step to practice acceptance of life exactly as it is. We're powerless over people, places, and things, so our job is to find a way to harmonize. The third step, it's kind of an investigation for me that, and in the second step, it's kind of recognizing not only that I have a path, because NA was my higher power. Program as it was the path out of the madness of my life. Not only do I have a path, but that the insanity is thinking I need something to be different outside of me, to be okay inside of me, or that I need something from the outside it, to change my insides. And in the third step, it's what Francis was talking about in a way with learning to practice anonymity, where it's like uncomfortable and really not doesn't come easily. Is to investigate, okay, this is the way it is. Where is God in this? Where are you, God? And that was the thing with grief. We can be a victim of our grief. And I know so many friends who have had a pet, and when the pet dies, the pain of the loss is so great that they decide they will never have a pet again. And that's one way to deal with it. And I don't judge anybody who's that way. But when I buy the pet, I actually hope I'm going to outlive it because the pet's going to live 10 years. And I kind of hope that I'm going to outlive it. And not only that, if I die first, who's going to feed the dog in the morning? But at the same time, when that moment of grief comes, it's the end of the world. And I don't know how to love and care anymore. And we armor up. But in the rooms, our experiences, our vulnerability is our strength. We fear vulnerability. It's counter to our instincts, our nervous system, but the heart, what happens is when we share our vulnerability, it becomes safe for others to share their vulnerability. And that's where the real deep healing takes place. A lot of deep healing.
Yeah, I agree completely. That's so many people, by sharing that vulnerability, has opened the door for me so many times. And that's why I think it's important. Like, if I'm going to a meeting now, and like I said, I've not been around as long as you guys, but I've been around for a while, that I can get into that old routine share where I'm just like, you got to get a sponsor, you got to work the steps, you got to, which is great. I mean, newcomers need to hear that, but at the same time, like, sometimes I forget that, hey, what really helps people is like when I tell the truth about where I'm at, not what people need to be doing, not what you should do. Like, when I get in there and talk about, so that's the first thing that I did after, when I went to a meeting after my mom passed away. I didn't sit in there acting like everything was fine. I just shared where I was at. And it was, and it didn't only help me, I know it helped others in the room. I think it says that somewhere in the literature, the what the thing that makes a good share is honesty. Being honest about where we're at. Francis, what are you cooking up over there, man?
I'm just deeply grateful for, like what you guys were talking about, and this miracle that we have, just like unfolding in front of us. I was kind of thinking about what Peter was talking about, like including like our nervous system in our communication with our higher power. Like he was talking from heart, from head to heart, right? But then also, like how else is God talking to us? Like what are the other instruments that I haven't recognized? Like I know. Like I sometimes think that God talks to me through my heart more than my head, like heartfelt longings. I think God hears that, I don't know, like about all the list of things I'm asking God for all the time. I'm pretty sure it's like if God were to refer to me, it'd be shut up, dumbass. Dumbass, shut up. I'm tired of listening to all this these requests. I'm going to give you what you need, but then you've just added like another piece to the puzzle tonight, like the nervous system. Wow. This morning I was, no, it was yesterday. I was meditating about like this basket, and I posted this on Facebook, but I was been trying to practice this thing called two-way prayer where I'm meditating on, what do I need to know and what do I need to do? And I started obsessing on the seventh tradition basket that I had just bought for this new group. And I'm like, what it, like th there's, I need to put a sign on this basket. Like, should this sign be laminated? How am I going to fasten the seventh tradition sign to the basket? Like, should I get ribbons? Should it be laminated? Like all this stuff. And then like, what came to me is like, get up and make the sign. And then it dawned on me that I'm out of time. I got to go to the fucking meeting. I got to pick up the newcomer. Like, screw the basket. Stop obsessing and go get busy. And when I get to the meeting, there's a little price tag on it with a number 7 on it. And like the sign is already there. The lesson was get up and go help the newcomer more than whatever I'm obsessing on. And like maybe that's my nervous system. I don't know, but there was a message in not obsessing and just going and participating in life. And
Francis,
so
it was odd not to hear you talk about your eyes, as
my
far as,
eyes.
yeah, your eyes as far as
Oh, I
connected with
see
God.
God.
I see you, God. That's Francis's thing. Yeah.
That's a
I
good
feel
one.
it. I feel it. Like I don't know that I think it, but I feel it. Like I
Yeah.
think it's in, like God using us is in the action. Like God doesn't drive parked cars. So
Was kind of like, I'm sorry, go ahead. It's this idea of like, meditating to improve a conscious contact. And it's like we're looking for this conscious contact. And what is that? when God is always available. If God, if this is all God's manifestation, then God is available always. And what we're practicing is being available for God. And that's when we can notice this breath. This breath, something as mundane as breathing, we do every moment of our life without a thought, without any effort, unless we're sick. This breath is absolutely miraculous. As the body's breathing and our lives are continuing in the exchange, we're breathing the sky, we're breathing out, and the sky is us, the atmosphere is us, we're breathing in the plants. I mean, something as mundane as the breath can absolutely reveal the miraculous when we show up, when we know not only how to pay attention, but quiet the mind enough to notice the perfection of the moment. That the seven, the little price tag seven's already on the basket. That in this moment, all of our needs are met. We're fed, we're clothed, we're sheltered, we're clean, we have a fellowship, a loving community. We're breathing, we're ambulatory. All of our needs are met. We're living in such abundance, but it's the mind that's constantly deconstructing and chopping things into pieces and seeking outside of ourselves because it's not satisfied with what is, because we're not really paying attention to the abundance of what is. And that we get reminded that this gift of recovery already makes any day a great day. Freedom from the active addiction, freedom from the obsession, 39 years later, is as absolutely as exciting and empowering as anything if I pay attention to it. And it's also, this is 11th step, the fruit of 11th step. We practice gratitudeless and we can think about what I'm grateful for. And oftentimes I think about being grateful that I'm clean. But if I'm not fully showing up for the feeling and the reality and the sensation and experience of that, the element of awe is missing from my gratitude. So there is a spat about awe and gratitude, gratitude and awe. When I am immersed in the sensation and the reality, experiencing the reality of gratitude, a feeling of awe comes in. And I'll tell you something, man, part of my meditation and life, we have like bells on our phone. And when the bell, these mindfulness bells randomly ring, and when they do, my wife and I stop what we're doing and we just go, ah. Try it. Make that sound, maybe not on recording, but maybe so. Ah. And it feels fucking great. Every out breath is a release. Every out breath is an ah. And at the end of that out breath, the body starts to crave oxygen. And when I breathe in, ooh, the body's nourished. It feels so good. I'm oxygenated. Ah, ooh. It's kind of, it gives me chills, man. But it takes practice to show up that way.
I always say that's the sound of surrender is like, ah.
Yeah.
And like the sound of not surrendering is, ah.
Yeah, mine's more like, well, fuck. Nothing I can do. I guess we've hit the hour threshold. Is there anything else any of you guys would like to share?
Super grateful, just
Yeah.
super, super grateful. Like as Daryl F would say, I'm so happy I could do a chicken dance.
I could do a chicken dance. Yeah, no, I'm grateful too, man. I really appreciate y'all. Thank you for not only doing this, but reaching out last week. Thank you for all you do for the fellowship and the newcomer and what you do for yourselves too. I appreciate both of you.
Thank you, brothers. It's an honor to know you both, and to be asked to share here. And I just hope we all keep unpacking what there is to unpack, no matter how good we got it and how great we understand the program. I think the reality is there's always more to unpack, and that to me is the fire, you know. And the work you guys are doing is absolutely amazing, and thank you so much.
Thank you,
Thank
Pete.
you.
And that'll do it for this week. We will be back next week with another episode. See you then.
This is the Living Clean Podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us.